This is Making Conversation, the Australian Composers Podcast.
Let's hear from composer Jenna Cave, who spoke with Antonia Zappia from her home in Marrickville in Sydney's bustling inner west. Those outside Sydney might not know Marrickville for its multicultural roots, trendy cafes, and for attracting many wonderful creatives to work and live. Marrickville also sits right under the flight path, so during this conversation you'll get a feel for its urban ambience and hear plenty of passing aircraft.
It is a beautiful Thursday morning. Thank you so much, Jenna Cave. We're in your lovely unit in Marrickville. I'm Antonia Zappia. Welcome to Making Conversation, part of Making Waves, interviewing fantastic, fabulous composers throughout Australia and overseas. So I'm going to start off with, if I was to introduce you to another one of my colleagues and friends and said, this is my friend, colleague, Jenna Cave. She's a, what would you say?
Composer, musician, band leader.
I was looking through your biography on your website, which I always compliment a composer when I see a really clear website. So thank you for that.
Oh.
It was very easy to navigate and it looks very, very swish.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
And you started on saxophone.
Yeah.
Yeah. What saxophone?
Alto sax.
Alto saxophone.
Yeah.
Did you start in primary school or?
Grade six. I started learning sax.
What pulled you towards the saxophone, or was it one of those instances where, oh, well, we only have these instruments left, so there you go, kids.
No, it was a definite choice. I can't actually remember consciously what made me want to do it. My mum seems to think it was the influence of The Simpsons and Lisa Simpson, because it introduced the saxophone to many young people, young girls.
Yeah, and she was actually such a good saxophone player in a lot of the episodes.
Yeah, amazing.
She talks about the passion of her instrument. She's really enthused by it, which is great, and I think it's a good role model for girls in popular culture to have this young lady who's extremely sharp and plays saxophone instrument. And you studied with John Mackey?
Yes.
John
Mackey in Canberra, yeah.
Did you consider any other places, or did you just think, well, I'm close to home, I'll go to the Uni of Canberra, it's got a music degree. Mm. Did you consider any other places?
It was the ANU. I did consider, but I was pretty young. I was only like 18, straight out of school, and I also was already at the Canberra School of Music because they had a pre-tertiary jazz program, which I did throughout year 11 and 12, which was actually a great program. It counted towards my year 12 certificate, so that was great, and I got to have lessons with John and play an ensemble and have like jazz theory class and stuff. So I was kind of already in there, and it was just like easier to just go there.
Of course, it's excellent that you actually were able to have that pre-tertiary study and have it count towards your end of high school exams.
Yeah,
we all
great.
Know that for some people, balancing an instrument and balancing academic work or, you know, whatever other extracurricular stuff they have can be really difficult. So that is encouraging to hear. Do they still have the program, the pre-tertiary program?
Well, they unfortunately the ANU kind of completely slaughtered all the actual music performance stuff, so they've still got a music school there, but it's not like a conservatorium. It doesn't have, you don't get like private lessons as part of it, so that's really kind of been watered down. But I think the pre-tertiary programs are still going, and that because they're partly funded by the ACT government. So obviously it doesn't have the same amount of teachers though there that are available, because a lot of the teachers were fired.
Mm.
But I believe there's still some stuff going on pre-tertiary, so that's something.
You finished your degree in 2006.
Yeah.
So a long time before all of that stuff transpired.
Mm.
Or
mm.
were there hints of it before you left?
I think there was always kind of pressure from the university. It's always going to be difficult incorporating an arts institution into the academic model the way that academia is funded, especially the research system, that people get funding from the government based on how many publications that the academics have published. Well, if you're a creative musician, you're not going to be, unless you're a musicologist, you're not going to be writing academic publications.
No, of course not. You're going to be doing what you did in your last year, which was co-producing an album.
Yeah.
In your last year of uni. How did you go about that?
That was quite a fun project. It was Sally Greenaway, who's still in Canberra and doing great stuff. It was her kind of brainchild. And she initially just started off, they had a, I think they still have it, a little group called the Friends of the ANU School of Music, who raise money and would give little grants to students for projects that would help with their careers. Her Sally originally applied for a grant. Actually, no, the first one I think was from another body in the ANU. And she applied for a grant. She wanted to record some of her music and then other music by other female jazz musicians in the course. And so it kind of started off with that. And then we applied for another grant from the Friends of the ANU School of Music to then get it mixed and produced and all that sort of thing. So it was quite a long process. It wasn't like my last album, which was like done in a short timeline. We kind of did it over a year and a half. But it was great. So I had three of my pieces on it recorded, and the School of Music had its own recording studio, and I basically just got ensembles from the ANU that were already playing my stuff and, you know, rehearsed them up even more and, yeah, got them to play on the recording. And, yeah, it was great, great experience.
I am interested to know, do you still play saxophone?
Yeah, well, I stopped for a while. I kind of go in and out. So when I was in Canberra, I stopped because I had an injury, like RSI, and then I sort of fell into composing as a way to complete my degree, like a really arbitrary thing, and then like started to love composing. And then I started playing again. And so when I was at ANU, just played in all the ensembles that were like playing my music as well. And then I moved up to Sydney and I was still playing a bit. And then I sort of made a decision when I finished my master's, because I was going to have to like try and earn a living and then do all these other things, like trying to start a big band and trying to work out how I was going to do this, where I just thought I don't want to stretch myself too thin, and I didn't want to, I could only do so much, so I decided just to kind of stop playing. But then I obviously missed it, and this year I've started teaching, and I teach like ensembles and I teach saxophone and various things, and I've just like started playing again, and yeah, it's great. So
did you find that when you came back to saxophone you were able to rehearse music or look at music in a different, in a much more analytical or structured way?
Well, I think definitely as I was, when I stopped playing saxophone, was just focusing on composing and band leading. You don't stop I was growing as a musician. So yeah. When I came back to then saxophone, obviously after not playing for a while, my technique was terrible and I couldn't play for more than 5 minutes without having a sleep afterwards.
it can be quite exhausting.
You're bringing all that musical knowledge with you and your musical ears with you, so it's all really the same thing, but that's just,
but you just need to build up your physicality.
Physical, yeah. And it's funny, as you kind of get older you realize that you've got a lot of time, and like even now I'm just like, I've been focusing the last few weeks on just completely like changing my sound and how I produce sound on saxophone and opening my throat up a lot and just really getting back to basics. And yeah, and you realize that it's not a race, you know.
Your most treasured memory from this journey so far?
I can think of just like little moments just popping into my head, but it's really just about making music with other people, and that is the most important thing. which is why I could never just be a composer sitting in my room and then just not knowing what happens to it, or just writing stuff that might never be played. Like, for me, it's all about the actual then bringing music to life. And there's just something so amazing about working with a group and you're all putting this energy in, and what beautiful things you can do together. So that's definitely the highlight of why I do it. And I can just think in my mind of just a number of little instances with the Divergence Jazz Orchestra, leading that band and conducting a bit with them, of just when we're performing and everyone coming together and it just sounding so amazing and just being in this sort of space, which is just wonderful. So I guess that's the reason.
You actually have a 19-piece big band that you conduct, you compose for. Have you ever played in?
No, I haven't. No.
You haven't?
No.
You're like,
maybe
you're thinking about it, you're like, yeah, that 5 minutes of playing soon comes 10, half an hour, and then I'm ready to go on stage. So the Divergence Jazz Orchestra, you started with Paul Weber?
Paul Weber.
Weber.
I just call him Tall. Paul Weber.
Tall Paul.
He is tall. Yeah.
Weber. Okay, Paul Weber. And is he an instrumentalist or is
he's a trombonist.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're kind of coming at it from different perspectives, which is nice.
Can you go through the timeline from even your first album release, which is the opening statement, that was in 2013.
Yes.
What was the timeline from, I'd like a big band, I want to see and hear my compositions performed, to getting to your very first album with the Divergence Jazz Orchestra? Take as much time as you need.
Well, when I was back at the ANU, I had my pieces being performed by like quite a few ensembles there. So the ANU Big Band, we had one called the ANU Jazz Recording Ensemble, which was kind of small, like 10 to 12 piece, and we did all original stuff and we played at jazz festivals and that sort of thing. The ANU Jazz Vocal Group, various people. So it's basically, that was my undergraduate degree, was writing jazz charts and then bringing it into different ensembles and then putting on recitals at the end of each semester.
So you already had that sense of working going, you go away, make something and then put it on the floor and see what happens.
Exactly, and developing things with a group of musicians. So I always thought, for me, that was what was the exciting thing about composing, is that bringing it to, you know, sitting there composing something and then being able to bring it to life with other people and hear it and then change it and all that sort of thing.
It doesn't just sit on a piece of paper in a folder somewhere collecting dust.
Exactly,
basically.
Exactly. Yep. So I guess from those early days, so that was back in 2004, I started doing the composing thing, to the 2006 at ANU, I thought, okay, if I'm going to keep doing this, I definitely want to have my own big band one day. Because I was just like, I have to, you know, otherwise it doesn't work, you know, it's not really the same. So then after that, I moved up to Sydney in 2008, started my master's at the Con. It took me quite a while to kind of get in the groove of Sydney, meet musicians. I felt kind of like quite isolated for a while. And I was learning from Bill Motzing, who at the time took the Con Big Band. And he, I got to bring my charts into the Con Big Band to be workshopped and played. During that process, I was still thinking, yes, I want my own big band one day. Because it's very different to just coming into someone else's ensemble. And it's, you can't really get what you really, really want out of a piece. Because there's one thing writing it down, there's another thing that you just can't write down in terms of how you want it played and how you want it developed and all that sort of thing.
So you felt you wanted to stand on the podium and lead and go, yeah, that phrase there, this is what I intended for this.
Yeah.
Because essentially you're authoring your own work. And
exactly.
You kind of want to now direct it. I mean, a lot of people do that in other art forms.
Yeah, exactly.
Acting and things like that, writing
exactly.
And directing. So.
And I think just being part of that process is also the fun part, you know, like, I mean, composing I obviously love too, but it's
how is this going to sound when it's on the floor.
Yeah, it's like creatively satisfying, and also to get Because, you know, in jazz, it's not this sort of dictatorial thing. To be able to get feedback from musicians or the rhythm section will play, try the groove I suggested and be like, ah, oh, no, that sounds really bad, and then get ideas from them and change things and what, like, it's inspiring as well as a composer. You're getting all this feedback from people. And that was always what I really wanted to do. So then I met Paul Weber at the con in the big band, and we would just chat occasionally at these things, it's concerts and rehearsals and parties and that sort of thing. And it came up in conversation that he wanted to form a big band one day, and I was like, I want to form a big band.
Hey, friend.
Hey. And then we just started like...
Let me take your card.
Yeah, and then he was saying, like, in his imaginary big band, oh, maybe we could commission you. And then we were like, oh.
Maybe we could commission you. Oh, funny.
So then, we just started talking about it quite a lot. And then he finished at the con. Oh, God, I don't know what year. No, that must have been... 2010, he finished his undergrad at the con, and then he went, then the next year he went over to the UK. He got like something called the Big Brother Fellowship or something, and did a few months over there getting lessons and stuff. And then even before he went, we're like, okay, we're going to do the big band, but we'll wait till you
it's going to happen.
We'll wait till you get. So it was like a year and a half.
It's like a long distance creative relationship. It's like, remember what you promised, buddy. You can't stay over in UK. You got to come back. We've got to start this big band.
So then he came back, I think like end of 2011, and then 2012, like, okay, we're going to start doing it. And he really had a lot of great ideas about how to run a big band, how to rehearse a big band, how to get it happening, because he came up playing in so many different big bands, and so he'd formed all these ideas, and that's part of the reason why he wanted to do it, because he had all these ideas of how you would make it good and what you would do. So then we had our first ever rehearsal at the beginning, February 2012, and we just got all these people together, mostly people that were like Paul's friends and colleagues and stuff, and a lot of people who were at the con at that time.
Are these people you had scouted in that year that he was away? Give me numbers. Give me yeah. Names. I will track these people down and be like, hey there. Hey there, friend. You want to be in the big band next year? You sure do.
So then we started off with just one rehearsal just to suss it out, played a couple of my charts, and then kind of got the lowdown of when people would be available, that sort of thing. And then I think in April of that year, we started doing it like, it was like rehearsing every second Sunday, but we didn't even have a gig booked or anything, but it was just sort of to start it off. And then we realized we need to put a gig on to like keep up the interest of everyone.
Yeah,
and so
of
actually
course. Yeah.
Doing it for something. And it was quite hard to get a gig. So then we put on our first ever gig at this hilarious place called the Bald-Faced Stag, which is like, it actually in the past it has had a lot of jazz. It's a pub on the corner of Parramatta Road and Balmain Road in Leichhardt. In the past it used to be a bit of a jazz venue, but these days it's more just has like has this room off the side where they just have like death metal and stuff. Anyway, so we thought we'd just put on a gig there because the people were like up for it and it was easy. So yeah, we put on our first gig there.
If you can't find a venue, then get your own.
Yeah, exactly. And there was a like really, really loud blues band in the bar next door and a curtain dividing the two, because the people who booked out the concert room were not the same people who ran the pub.
Oh wow.
So most of the time we were winning in the battle, except for in the ballads. Then like you can hear this like in the recording, the video, you can hear this metal band go, rah, rah, rah. So that was pretty funny.
It's a music off. It's a playoff. to the death.
So yeah, so we started doing, I think we did like four gigs in that year. So we did a couple at the Stag, did a couple at Bohemian Grove, which was like an underground jazz and experimental venue in Surrey Hills. They've closed down, but now they present somewhere else, so they still put on shows. And then yeah, it was always, I always wanted with the band, like from the very start, it was like, we want to record an album. And I was thinking just at least one album, and then before just, I die.
No. Like, and now you've got two, you're like, gosh, I really hope that my health stays good so I can get out a third.
So it was all kind of with the mindset of that's what we would do. Because I had all, had so much music I'd written, and it just had never, like, done, you know, been performed by bands here and there, but it'd never been really put out there.
Now it's 2016, we're 3 years on.
Mm-hmm.
You've had a few members come and go, mm-hmm. but you've still got 19 members all up.
Yeah, so including me. Including you. So that's 19 of us total. Yeah.
El Capitan.
Yeah.
The captain. And has Paul, does Paul mainly focus on performance, or does he do some composing as well in the band?
Yeah, so Paul isn't a composer, so he focuses on performing and leading, and I think everything we do, we decide together what music we're going to play, or concerts that we organise with special guests and personnel, all that stuff is kind of decided between us. So, yeah.
So Fake It Until You Make It, you've only just released that, and you had the launch in October.
Yeah, so last month.
The Foundry, how did that go?
It was great, yeah, it was really good, because, I mean, it can be hard to get people out these days to hear original live music, and... Yeah, we've had a lot of gigs on weird nights of the week, like Wednesday night, Tuesday night, and people still come, but, you know, it's hard to get a good crowd. But with this one, because it was the launch of the album as well, we got publicity and I was promoting like mad, just like, I'm sorry to everyone who's friends with me on Facebook. So just like, what I posted.
Hey guys,
like,
you're coming to my album.
Promoting and this stuff, and got posters put up and all that sort of thing. And yeah, it was on a Friday night as well, which helps. And yeah, we had a great crowd. The band played really well. Had some, yeah, quite a few musicians turn up, which is always nice because, you know, you want other people in your community to hear what you're doing. And yeah, it was a great thing.
It's good as well that you have that supportive environment, not only just for, it seems that because it's Paul and you, and he's more leaning towards performance and you're band leading and conducting and composing, you've got the best of both worlds. So you can critique it from the sake of, oh, maybe that didn't, that section there that I wrote, maybe that didn't quite work. And then Paul's like, no, it was just not played maybe the way that it
exactly
it could have.
Exactly.
So yes. You've got these two sides of the coin, two perspectives that can actually, I guess,
works really well together.
Yeah, work well together. Something that people may not know, which I'm going to tell them now, surprise everyone, you also write chamber music.
Yeah.
Is there anything you don't write?
Probably.
You have Trilogy for Strings.
Yes.
And it has been performed already, or it is going to be performed, because we're running out of November.
Yes.
We're running out of days in November.
Well, apparently in Russia, things are very, like, last minute, so I don't even know what date, but it's happening. My friend sent me a photo of the poster this morning in Russian,
with no date on the poster, just like there's a poster and
it's in Russian, so I can't see, there's like a number somewhere on it, so
somewhere you're that could be
but I think in the next couple of weeks, so yeah, basically it was my string quartet number one, which I wrote in 2010, which I managed to get recorded, but I've never had performed, I guess because I'm not really in the chamber world enough, so I don't really have people that I can say, hey. But I've put like 6 months of my life into this thing. It's like a three movement string quartet. Anyway, and then recently, Hoshimi Sakai, who went to the con, she's now in Russia and she's done a whole like conducting degree in Russia. She's also a classical trumpet player. She has a string group there now called Warm and Peace. And
It's a cute name.
It is very cute. And she, yeah, just asked if I had anything for string orchestra, and I said, well, no, but I wrote this string quartet and it's never been performed. So she listened to it and she really liked it. She said, oh, I think it would work for a string orchestra. So after the album launch and everything, I gave myself, I don't know, a week off, and then I started getting into, like, rewriting this string quartet for a string orchestra.
String orchestra.
Yeah, so it's the same piece, but I had to kind of... It took a while to get back into the mindset of that piece because I wrote it so like 6 years ago, and yeah, add a bass part, but also think of it like, okay, this is not just five players; it's an orchestra.
For Jazz Australia, where you talked about giving a piece that space. So you said with the most recent album, there were some tracks where, you know, it had taken you 6 months from beginning to end. Why do you take that time? Why do you think it's important?
It just seems to give me the space to reflect on what's working musically. I know some people write really quickly. I don't understand. I guess I could, like, but it's just like it's not going to be up to the level that I want it to be. I'm a bit of a perfectionist. I also want it to be, each time I write a new piece, I want it to be challenging myself, and I want it to extend, and I want to be doing something, saying something different. So I want it to be something carefully considered. Otherwise, I just think, well, there's not much point. It's not like I'm making money out of this, so I may as well put everything into it. And I think also when I've taken a long time, sometimes because I've been working other jobs and been busy with life as well, so I may only have like half a day a week to compose. But I do think that time to reflect on it and be able to listen when I'm writing, listen to it as if I'm an outsider, and be able to like come back to a passage and think, listen to it and go, oh no, that bit doesn't work, or can't try and listen to where it should go next. That takes a bit of time and space, and not something to be rushed.
Yeah. What outside of music most inspires you and your work? Hedgehog teacups.
I'm definitely inspired by other arts, like visual arts. I'm not like a connoisseur. I don't know like who are the, you know, the history of art, but I do like going to like the art galleries and just looking at stuff. And I find it's really interesting because sometimes the emotional effect it has on me, it just feels like it's the same as music. Like I just get so, I don't know, that sounds weird, but yeah, it definitely inspires me. Yeah, other forms of arts like reading and watching films and those sorts of things. But also just like life itself. I sound so lame. But just like being in nature and that sort of thing. Or my parents have a holiday house down in the like south coast of New South Wales, kind of past south of Canberra. And just like going there and being in the quiet and just... Yeah, that kind of thing, it's inspiring, I think. And, yeah, and also just, like, I'm very inspired just by life experiences and, you know, yeah. So it's a lot of what I try and put into my music is basically, like, a reflection of my own life experiences and trying to put some of that into kind of a narrative form, even though it's not narrative in the way, like... a film or book would be. In my mind, I know that it's like an emotional journey that I'm kind of putting out there, and it's going somewhere, and I'm putting some of my lived experience into that. If that makes sense.
When you talked about before about nature and things like that, do you believe in inspiration? Do you believe in going outside and you're experiencing something or you're in a moment and you just suddenly hit by, I need to get home or I need to get out my phone and write this down because I feel that this could be the start of something. Do you believe in inspiration?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's just sort of how my mind always is working. Like, I mean, yeah, I tend to not be inspired when I'm really busy with something, but then if I have a quiet time and then winding down and then listening to music or doing something and really enjoying something, then I'll feel like, oh, I want to write something. I don't believe in this thing that you get struck by this thing from God and then it's just like the whole symphony is in your head. Like, no. But I do, yeah, I definitely have moments where of inspiration, but it's more just like I then want to do it. I feel like maybe I have an idea or sometimes I might not even have an idea, but I know I want to find an idea. So it's more just like an excitement, I think, for me.
It's an enthusiasm for what you're doing.
Enthusiasm, yeah.
And you want to go out searching. You're like, there's always another adventure to be had.
Exactly, yeah. And just, yeah, and then you get this feeling that you want to make the music.
Making that time as well, as you said, you've talked about the space that you have between, you know, starting a piece and finishing a piece and being able to look back over it and go, this is working, this is not working, what I intended, not what I intended. How do you balance that with life in general? Like, how do you support yourself financially and, you know, make that time, make that space?
It's been a difficult experiment. Well, it was nice when I was, like, doing my master's because then I was, like, had a scholarship and I could just write and... That was actually a great experience of 2 years of studying with Bill Motzing, and my working hours were just thinking about music and getting really like deep into it. And then I got a bit of a shock after I finished that and I had to like go out and earn money. And I'd done some teaching when I was younger, but I didn't feel like I felt confident enough to just do that and just make that my kind of profession at that point. So I started doing like admin work. So I was working at the UTS for like 4 years, started doing like research admin, like 3 days a week. And then gradually over time, as these things do, you have to do more and more hours.
They're like, we need you. Don't leave us. You're part of the team now. You're like, okay, guys.
And so that period of trying to do these admin jobs, that was a pretty stressful period of my life because I was also then, in that period, starting a big band, working out how to, like, be in the music industry. Because it's one thing, you know, composing, getting your craft together, but then leading a band and then trying to put on gigs and
publicity,
trying to make recordings happen.
Contacts.
Yeah, so that was...
Producers.
Stressful, yeah. And then, all of that. And it's, you know, building up confidence and stuff and then trying to... And then still composing. The good thing about composing is that I actually find it therapeutic, like music making is therapeutic. So amongst all that busyness, you are motivated to then get back to the creative stuff because that's the thing that makes you feel good. It was a difficult time and it took me quite a while to kind of get my shit together.
I
was just like staring at the thing. And then I made the decision that I wanted to like be a music teacher, like get back into teaching. My husband's a teacher, he's a high school teacher, not music, but seeing him, how he talk about his students and stuff, like it really inspired me. And I always thought that teaching should be something you should only do if you actually have some inspiration and feel inspired to share. I didn't want to be like a bitter teacher. So I started teaching beginning of this year. So I teach saxophone and lead a bunch of like school ensembles and really enjoy it and get a lot out of it, get a lot from the kids. I find I am inspired by them. And actually that's one of the things, like how I got back into playing. I was teaching sax, but I was also had this student that I'm teaching jazz to and he's getting into improvising stuff and it just like really inspired me to then go and practice myself and just get
back.
Because
if you want to teach, you want to have some things to be able to inspire them with. Like, oh, hey, I tried this on the weekend.
Yeah.
Why don't you?
And it wasn't even like because I thought, oh, that would be the sensible thing to do. It was just like talking about it. I was like,
oh, I want to
so
play.
So exciting.
I want to play.
Yeah, exactly.
Conversation podcast is brought to you by Making Waves. Making Waves is a free online listening resource bringing listeners the latest new music from Australian composers. We'd love for you to discover, listen, like, subscribe, and share new Australian music. You can find us at makingwavesnewmusic.com. We'd like to thank all the people who made this season possible. This includes the supporters of our crowdfunding campaign, project patron Cameron Lamb of Camaclan, and Creative Partnerships Australia's match funding program. The series production team is Leah Blankendahl, Stephanie Eslake, Sasha Kelly, David John Lang, Matthew Lorenzen, Rebecca Aaron Smith, Chris Williams, Antonia Zappia, Daniel Thorpe, Thomas Green, Lisa Cheney, and Peggy Polias, along with interns Angus Baxter, Malena Radice, and Mark Wolfe. The podcast theme music was the work I/O by Australian composer Elia Simic Prozik. If you wish to learn more about the composer, music or interviewer featured in this episode, head to our website and click podcast to view the show notes. If you're enjoying these podcasts from Making Waves, there are a number of ways in which you can show your support. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes or your favourite app. You might even like to leave a review. You can also share this episode and the series with your networks. Making Waves is a voluntary endeavour. If you're interested in volunteering or interning with us, we'd love to hear from you. We also encourage you to consider making a small one-off or continuing donation to support the ongoing promotion of new Australian music and composers. Visit makingwavesnewmusic.com/support.